Hello and welcome to the February 2016 episode of Radio Wild. I'm Chris Anderson, along with my co-host, Alan Lacey. It's been a great start to a new year, and one that I'm excited to tell you about. Our production company, Sawtooth Legacy Films, recently released our second of three films in the Great Predator Debate series titled A Nation's Dilemma. During that interview process, we spoke to experts across the field of biology and industry in three states. This episode of Radio Wild presents the second half of Oregon Wild representative Rob Clavin's interview. Please keep in mind, these recordings are interviews conducted during the filming of our documentary and are in part a recreation of those conversations, edited for your pleasure and your information.
Before we jump into that interview, let's take a moment to update you on a couple of Wolf Camp projects. The Great Predator Debate is in the can, so to speak, and ready for your viewing. We've received terrific early reviews from not only participants like Bob Beshta and Dominic Aiello, but also viewers across the continent. My film, Gray Area, Wolves of the Southwest, is also in high gear for completion by summer of 2016, but it could be done as early as May, depending upon how we go with our distribution process. And finally, Chris and I will begin filming not only the third installment of the Great Predator Debate that focuses on the many solutions that exist, but together, we'll undertake a 12-segment project titled Kidwin's Explores, Wolves, where we introduce the public to experts who take us up close and personal to what makes wolves a special species.
So, with that housekeeping out of the way, let's pick up where we left off a month ago with Rob Clavin's.
Hello again, Rob. Let's continue discussing wolves and their place in Oregon. A question that's been on my mind is that there are those who claim that predators can cause a tremendous financial blow to a livestock operation, which, if it's a small operation, seems plausible. But then there are those who say that the predators are a small factor in things that kill livestock, for example, weather and disease, etc. Do predators kill a lot of livestock?
The last year for which we have statistics in the state of Oregon, there's 1.3 million cows. 55,000 died before they made it to the slaughterhouse from weather, disease, domestic dogs, human thieves, native wildlife, poisonous plants, what have you. I think it was 3,800 were claimed as lost to predators. And that includes domestic dogs, that includes eagles, that includes scavengers. Wolves killed two cows last year. Certainly the numbers are different for different species, but I think it's really important to contextualize that. So two versus 3,800 versus 55,000. And again, you know, I would argue that if your business in the 21st century depends on killing an endangered species to make a profit, that might not be a great business model for the 21st century. And again, I think, though, that isn't to make it all black and white. So often the wolf issue, and I'm sorry, I keep thinking wolves instead of just predators. So often wildlife and predator issues are seen as this very polarized black and white, kill them all, don't kill another animal. And I don't think for most people that's the reality. I think most people do have some, are more reasonable. They're more interested in solutions. It's just it's hard to get in the front page of the newspaper with a sign that says who wants moderation now, who wants rational solutions, we do. That's not as pithy, but I think that said, it's frustrating because to the extent that it is a polarized debate, and there are certainly are people who have polarized views politically, what have you. In terms of the practice, there's not a whole lot of polarity. There's definitely a poll where you've got states like Wyoming where you can kill wolves on sight most of the state.
Rob, do you think there is a connection to nature that brings value to us as human beings?
You know, I guess I see value in for myself, and maybe it's a selfish thing, but as a kid, you know, I grew up playing outside, fishing and hiking and hunting and doing all the fun stuff, playing in the mud, picking up frogs, all that sort of thing. And I've always loved that, and I think even as an adult, I still find wonder. And I understand a lot of people love, New York City is a great place. The foodies in Portland love it, and I see value to all those things. I love going to a Timbers game and all that sort of stuff. But that to me is not it's not nearly the same thing as what I can find in nature when I can go hiking in the Eagle Cap and I can come across a waterfall that I didn't know was there, and I feel like I discovered it. Or I come across the tracks of an animal, and I wonder what's happened before me, what's going to happen elsewhere. there's something about that to me that is just irreplaceable of anything that we compared to something anything that we can create. And so to me, there's some value in that. And I think when it comes to, you know, to wildlife, and especially the big wildlife that have struggled because they need big landscapes, or controversial wildlife that have struggled because we have some prejudice against them, for founded or otherwise.
Do you feel that certain animals like wolves, cougars, bears, and other iconic species have become glorified in the minds of people? Or do you think they are more of a representation of what's wild?
You know, those animals sort of end up being a symbol of wild places. And for that matter, the last generation, speaking of wolves in Oregon, didn't have the opportunity to even contemplate seeing a wolf in Oregon. They'd have to go up to Canada. You know, you don't have to go to Canada or Alaska anymore. And I think that that's something worth passing on to future generations. I think they should have the opportunity to have as rich a landscape and as many opportunities as I had, if not more. And, you know, as I say, we've come from a place where we were destroying all of that. It's not all back yet. You know, that we've made species go extinct. There are still a lot of species on the brink. There are a lot of natural systems that are on the brink. And I think as good stewards for ourselves, for future generations, and to have some humility to understand that we're part of something bigger, whatever that means for you, I think that's worth protecting. And I think that, again, selfishly, but also more broadly, we would do well to be a little bit more humble, to be a little bit more generous, to be a little bit more compassionate, and to try to leave space in our hearts on the landscape for wildlife that may be difficult to live with, that we may be a little bit scared of, that may make us uncomfortable. I think we owe it to ourselves, to future generations, and again, to just some sort of humility in that we don't understand everything. I wish I could riff off the Aldo Leopold quote about the key to intelligent tinkering. I can send it to you. It's a great quote. You know, even if we don't necessarily see the value to it, if it was here, there was probably some value to it. And I think it's important. I think it's worth protecting.
It most certainly is in my mind too. There's more to it than just getting out and loving nature. How does one go about protecting these wild places?
Unfortunately, you know, I spend most of my time arguing about policy and politics and trying to, you know, get a better understanding of science and fact check and those sorts of things, and sending emails back and forth and those sorts of things, which are not, you know, I spent precious little time out there. But boy, you know, when I do actually get a couple days to put a backpack on and go into a wild place, that's where I can't finish the sentence, because I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, because it's just something so inherent. Maybe there's something to be said of if you have to explain it, or you have to have it explained to you, you don't understand it. And just like, you know, I don't understand the fashion industry. I don't necessarily see the value in that, but that doesn't mean there is no value in it. And so anyway, I think it's worth protecting. So my sister works in the fashion industry, so don't put that in there. but, you know, so I think, yeah, you know, maybe we don't understand what the value of something may be, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have value. Sometimes it's hard to articulate, and sometimes it's hard to quantify the value of something, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't have value. And ecologically, economically, there are values to having wildlife out there. And certainly when it comes to apex predators, and, you know, it's funny, whenever I use the word predator, we sort of done a disservice in the conversation, because the word predator is such a loaded term. You know, having a predator in your neighborhood is not what you want to hear. So sort of, I think predators are sort of at this disadvantage. You know, what do we call them? They're native hunters. They're doing, you know, they were given pointy teeth. They were given claws. That's what they're meant to do, just in the way the elk is meant to chew the grass. And that's what they're doing. To the extent that bears and cougars and wolves are controversial, it's not their fault. It's our fault. It's our problem. And we can solve it by getting rid of them, or we can solve it by tapping this big brain we've got and trying to solve problems and trying to avoid conflict and trying to coexist.
Hey Rob, Alan here. Science has been one of the ways we can better understand these issues. How does science play a role in dealing with nature and better understanding it?
And again, I kind of keep going back to that humility thing, though. I think of understanding that if, you know, that and science, I think it's important to note, science is showing us that native hunters play a critical and irreplaceable role on the landscape. We get into a lot of troubles trying to fix things with the same thinking that, you know, is that Einstein's quote? We get into a lot of trouble trying to fix things by doing what we've always done, just doing more of it. And, you know, I think that we should understand that the studying ecology is complex. And we depend on that same ecology. We depend on those same landscapes that all these native species do. And when you take one of those pieces out, you make changes that you might not have quite understood, and we might not be able to replicate. We do that with forestry. We think that a clear cut replicates a forest fire. That's not the same thing. Forest fires don't leave logging roads, and forest fires leave snags, and they do all of these different things that we don't do. And likewise, we might think that, boy, if we want to run the state as a game farm and have it, just all we care about is want to make it as easy as possible to bag an elk, sure, get rid of all the competition. But there are a lot of hunters out there who really see the value in sharing the landscape. Maybe there's a little bit more of a challenge because maybe there are a few less elk out there. Maybe that's an elk that now has been hunted 24/7 all year round that you're competing with, and that makes it different, or that makes it difficult. So you can see that as, oh, that's competition, we got to go kill those predators. Or you could actually see that as, that's going to make me a better hunter. And I really personally, growing up, and I grew up hunting, I don't hunt anymore. I see a lot more value in that conservation ethic that the people that I hunted with as a kid really instilled in me of sharing that landscape of, you know, you see the wolf track and that's cool.
So tell me, Rob, how do you go about solving these issues before us? So many of these issues rely on science, yet sometimes it feels like science isn't adhered to.
And a lot of the work I do forests and how are we managing forests and landscapes in terms of prescribed fire and that sort of thing. And so there definitely is sort of a dichotomy of you know, we want to solve problems and we believe what we know now is the best and we should double down on that and we should go for that, versus a little bit more of a humble perspective of nature has done pretty darn well for a really long time and we're a part of that. But we have, because of our technology, we have a disproportionate reach and a disproportionate impact, and therefore I think more responsibility to get it right. And when it comes to especially a population of 7 billion people in this developed landscape that we live in, I think it's important to apply a bit of a precautionary principle. We're living in changing times. And so, sure, you know, grizzly bears aren't going to be able to live in downtown Boise anymore, where once they did. That's just the reality of it. They're species we're never going to bring back, that they're extinct, they're gone. But, you know, especially when we talk about, I think, sort of, again, not necessarily specific to predators, but when you're thinking about what is the value of the wild or of nature, or, you know, there's a long philosophical conversation to be had there. But there's something to be said for it's a control to the experiment that we're running on the other 96% of the landscape here in Oregon. It's a control to that experiment that we're running on the landscape. It's a refuge for those natural processes that we might find out that were really, really important. And, you know, when it does come to keystone species, that's the whole definition of the term keystone species. And it's not just wolves, it's sea otters. It's grouper in the ocean. It's jaguars. It's leopards. All sorts of other species. Sometimes it's animals that are less charismatic. It's beavers.
One of the questions that comes to my mind is this: would it be better for nature to take its course rather than trying to manage it on our own? If we focus on preserving and protecting it, is that enough?
So we sort of have a nascent understanding of ecology because it's really complex. You know, going on out there, we've got geology interacting with climate, interacting with biology, all of those, chemistry, all those different things are happening on the micro scale up to the macro landscape scale. And we can't fully understand it. So keystone species is where I was going with that. And there's a lot of different ways that animals can be keystone species. You've got ecosystem engineers like beavers that create habitat that wouldn't exist otherwise. You have umbrella species like wolverine, that if we're going to protect what wolverine need, and wolves are also an umbrella species, that if we can protect these big landscapes and the prey base on which these animals depend, we're protecting all the smaller things, the creepy crawlies that aren't nearly as charismatic, that don't get included in documentary films, that people don't really spend much time thinking about, but are really critically important. If we can protect those landscapes, especially in a changing world, it's really important. If we just have isolated populations of wildlife in Yellowstone and Crater Lake and Wallowa County and up in Alaska, that might not be able to survive in the long term. And as I've probably re-ringing the bell a few times, but as we're trying to get it right, a lot of wildlife right now is sort of getting a second chance, and they may not get a third chance. And I think it is really important that we get it right.
Rob, can you tell our listeners how wolves play a specific role in taking care of an ecosystem?
I could talk for 6 hours and tell you everything I know and every personal philosophy I have, and at the end of the day, you boil it down, and Aldo Leopold said it in like 40 words. Aldo Leopold said the key to intelligent tinkering is to keep all of the pieces, whether you understand their value or not. And so when you start to take pieces out or add more of something or put it back, you have changes that we don't necessarily expect. And we're still learning about them. It is incredibly complex, and it's hard to understate how complex it is. And so when it comes to, for instance, the trophic cascades of wolves, the return of wolves in Yellowstone, we're seeing all sorts of impacts we never expected. But generally speaking, when you have all the parts of a landscape, it's a healthier landscape. And it's a more resilient landscape. And it's going to be more resilient in the long term.
There are some scientists that are saying that trophic cascades aren't exactly directly related to wolves. Is this true in your opinion? Is there more to it?
And for the sake of sound bites, it's often things get oversimplified. And so there may be a perception that, for instance, with the study out of Yellowstone, just add wolves, everything gets better. It's not quite that, magically simple. It's very complex. And over time, I think we're starting to learn more and more. And all of these different parts of the ecosystem and the landscape, whether it's plants and amphibians and weather and climate and geology and chemistry, are all interacting with each other. So we shouldn't necessarily assume that we can just do X and expect Y to happen. That's just not the way it works. But I think it behooves us to study it, to try to learn as much as we can, to try to understand it as best we can. But going back to it, to have a little bit of humility, to understand that that what we know right now might not be the right answer, and we might know something better down the road. And if we're gonna have a default, if we're gonna err on one side or the other, I'd argue deferring to what nature has created for millennia before we got here and started tinkering with it. And certainly that doesn't mean we should take a total hands-off approach everywhere. That's just not, whether maybe that is the answer, but it's certainly not a practical answer. That's not what we're going to do in the 21st century. We don't have to make this choice between living in a dark cave cowering from ravenous wolves, or living in cush space age apartments where we push buttons and the right food comes out in Soylent Green or whatever. And so as we learn, we also do have to understand that one of the big things are the impacts that we're having on the landscape. We're not separate from nature, but we certainly have a disproportionate impact, and we certainly have this ability to make decisions in a way other animals can't, or other parts of the ecosystem can't, to think ahead, to think about the consequences, to try to aim and steer towards different outcomes. But we've altered the landscape significantly. There's no doubt about that. But I think there's still room in the West, and there's still room on this earth for the animals that belong here, whether you believe that God placed them here or they evolved or whatever your belief system is. They're here, and I think there's still a place for that. Even you look at this landscape around us, this is a tremendously beautiful place, but we've altered a lot of it. You can see straight lines behind me where trees end and fields start, and there's roads and all that sort of thing. There's big fences in a lot of places to keep the elk out, so they're not eating our stuff. So we've definitely altered that landscape. And we can continue to do that. We can double down on that and call it progress and call it, economic, call it the path to prosperity.
How do ranchers see this? Wolves have caused quite a bit of hardship on some of them. I'm sure they would love to see wolves removed from the landscape.
I think there's a perspective of we don't want to kill all the wolves. We don't want to kill everything. We just want to protect our livelihood. And that's a, you know, I understand that. I have a livelihood that I care about as well. The cathartic way that I said it before is, you know, if your business model in the 21st century depends on killing an endangered species, you might want to reconsider your economic model. But I think that it's sort of, a lot of it has to do with just doing things differently.
Hey, Rob, one of the more common things we hear is that ranchers wouldn't mind the wolves as much if they were allowed to protect what's theirs instead of being investigated and potentially fined or imprisoned for shooting a wolf that killed one of their cattle. Do you have any insight on this?
All right, so, you know, I think there's a perspective of people saying they just want to protect their livelihood. They want the freedom to be able to do that in the way that they see fit. And certainly I think one of the places where there comes a lot of conflict with especially predators in the livestock industry. So there's sort of a conflict between the old way people used to do things, which was simple, pick up a gun, put out the trap, put out the poison, and also just sort of a sense of independence of, I got a problem, you know, it's sort of the mystique of the cowboy. You know, I've got a problem, I solve it the best way I know how, I'm independent, I take care of my own problems. And now, because we've kind of run into the limits of a lot of things, you know, natural systems of what's developed, what's not developed, and we've said, as a society, there is some value to what's wild, and sometimes that's inconvenient because it's messy, because it spills over, the deer and the elk jump the fence and eat the grass that was meant for the cow, or, you know, the wolf goes through and on its way to go find the elk that it should be eating, it finds an injured calf and it eats that injured calf instead, and that causes problems sometimes. And so there's this feeling of, well, I know, you know, I solve my own problems, I'm independent, here's how I'm going to solve my problem, that's a threat, I'm going to kill it. When maybe there actually is not just a better way for that wolf who doesn't want to get shot, but there might actually be a better way that actually solves both problems. Because I think the vast majority of people, you know, we talk about these polls, but I think the vast majority of people would probably agree with the statement that they want to see wildlife, healthy, abundant populations of wildlife, and recovery of native species that works for everyone. Certainly there's a balancing act there, so maybe there's a little bit more emphasis on, I want to see recovery at all costs, or I want to see my economic prosperity at all costs, whatever that means, you know, and then there's somewhere we're kind of tilting that. But I think in a perfect world, most people would want to see that.
Do you think that the current discussion going on around the country to delist wolves could allow ranchers more freedom and may create more tolerance towards wolves if that were to occur?
We have 77 known wolves in the whole state, 26 of which are pups, less than a year old. So we're having a conversation where we're talking about, let's prioritize conservation. When it comes to species, once a species has recovered, when they're more abundant, we can have a different conversation. But, you know, when we were talking about taking out entire packs of wolves, when there are only 12 wolves in the state, that's a big, big problem.
Do you think it's necessary to have predator control programs that manage predators? People have been killing coyotes at will, and yet coyotes are still around. And as is the argument we hear from anti-wolf people, would it be the same for wolves? And how can we balance populations of predators when you have several opposing views on how to manage them?
So I'm not saying I'm supportive of the policy, but there's no limit on how many coyotes people can kill. And I'm not saying that I think we should go out and kill every coyote or that that's necessarily appropriate, but you don't see the same amount of conflict. Same thing with cougars. You know, there are people who want to be able to have dogs tree them and then kill them that way because it's easier and we can reduce the population more that way. And there's a debate about other people saying it's unethical and all that kind of stuff. So certainly it's not, you know, there's not just one line of argument and discussion and then we're done. These are complex problems and complex issues that we've been grappling with forever. And we used to solve it one way. And now we're sort of in this decision point. And I keep on kind of going back to that. And I think there's some real truth to that of, we're trying to get it right. It's not clear if we will, and you kind of want to ask the question, can we afford not to? And that goes beyond just predators, and I think predators are a small piece of it. But I think that's really the issue there is if we're having a polarized conversation of kill them all, don't kill any, it's hard to, you know, come up with some solutions. But even within that, something slightly less than kill them all, but give me the authority to kill whenever I want to, that's what got us into the mess in the first place.
Do you think it's hard for some people to allow themselves into a conversation about ecology with wolves when they've been brought up believing wolves are dangerous and should be controlled lethally, or on the opposite side, for pro-wolf people to have a conversation with a rancher with those opposing views? Is it possible to even find common ground, or does it cause damage in some instances?
I spent a lot of time talking with people with very different perspectives than I, but what I've come to find is most people understand that we've come a long way since killing native wildlife and Native Americans was an appropriate way of doing business in the West. But for some, old prejudices die hard, and they can do a lot of damage. And we've seen that all across this country, not just on ecological or environmental issues. Because I don't think it was ever anybody's stated intention to say, let's get rid of all the old growth. Let's make species go extinct. With the case of some predators, that's not true. But for the most part, we don't want to cause damage, I don't think. I've spent a lot of time talking with folks who have very different perspectives on these sorts of things. And I think it's important to understand where people are coming from. But in the world we live in now, where we have, we've altered the climate. We've changed. There's find a place on the globe where we haven't made some sort of impact. And so I think in the 21st century, if there's a place that's still wild, maybe it's worth keeping it that way. If there's an animal that's still hanging on by its fingernails, maybe we should do something to try to protect it and keep it around. And sometimes that can be difficult. It can challenge the way people have thought about things for a long time. It can change the way they have to do business. But I think that there is some value to keeping what we have, if nothing else, just for a precautionary principle, if nothing else for future generations, so that they can have at least as many opportunities, if not more, than we have. There was a recent legal challenge on the state's wolf program, and as a result of that, we spent 17 months in negotiations with the state environmentalists, the livestock industry. And I think we all the people who participated in that process walked away with a better understanding of each other. It doesn't mean we agree, but at least we have a better understanding. I think, I certainly understand some of the challenges and that I didn't maybe give as much credibility to as I should have before. I may have a different idea for the solution. And the best part of this, I don't know if I've said enough, is that, like, these solutions... You know, if it's really about protecting your livestock, if it's really about having a healthy landscape, if it's really about reducing conflict, let's choose the best way. And if the best way isn't necessarily the easiest way, and if it isn't just the most cathartic way or just the way Granddaddy did it, there's resistance to that. And it's just that's what's sort of challenging to overcome. And I don't know that when it comes to a changing world that we have a whole lot of time and that we have a whole lot of margin for error left.
Thank you, Rob, for taking the time to talk with us on this important topic. It's been a pleasure hearing about the work that you do, and it's always reassuring to know there are people who are working for the betterment of wildlife and our wild places.
Well, folks, that wraps up our program for today. Make sure to tune in each month as we air another new, exciting, and fresh episode of Radio Wild. It's been a lot of fun discussing the great predator debate over the course of the last year. We've interviewed a wide variety of people like television host and National Geographic explorer Casey Anderson, Nelson Wewa from the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Indian Reservation, trapper Stan Thomas, Predator Defense Council's Brooks Fay, and many others.
You can follow us online at facebook.com/wolfcenter or on our website, www.wolfcenter.org, where you'll find tons of informative material on wolves and other predators on our western landscape. Stay tuned for more exciting events and programs coming soon.